Putin, far from cuddly. Today, Friday, March 21st. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. As the West struggles to figure out Vladimir Putin, a reporter recalls his dinner with the Russian leader back in 2007.
He didn't care about us. He didn't care if we didn't like him. He got up in the middle of dinner and said, well, I could see we're done, and walked out of the room, which is an extraordinarily rude thing for anybody to do.
Also, an Iranian-American comedian finds the toughest audience is his own family.
Sometimes you can't crack them. The Persian grandma, you know, she's wearing her hijab. You can't even tell by her facial reactions if she's laughing because it's covered up.
Plus, celebrating the Persian New Year by leaping over open flames.
Well, I love fire, so any reason to make a fire is right up my alley.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. What will Putin do? That seems to be the question as the crisis in Ukraine continues to unfold. Today, President Obama's National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, said the U.S. is keeping an eye on Russian troop movements near the border with eastern Ukraine. She said American officials are skeptical of Putin's assurances that the movements are nothing more than a military exercise. There are lots of experts out there who claim to know what makes Vladimir Putin tick, but the Russian leader remains mostly an enigma, which is why we start today by speaking with someone who got to know Putin a little in an interview and then over dinner back in 2007. Journalist Adi Ignatius was helping prepare a profile for Time magazine, which is naming Putin Person of the Year. Ignatius wrote about the experience of dining with Vladimir in an article for Politico this week, and he tells me that several things about Putin quickly became clear.
I don't think he's crazy. I think there are people now who say, well, Putin is partly strategic and partly crazy. There's nothing to suggest he's crazy. He is an absolute Russian nationalist. He realizes that playing that card effectively is the best way to win support, and we're seeing that right now. I mean, you know, he's just reacquired territory for Mother Russia, and there's nothing that will make you more popular than pulling that off. But he also was very prickly. And
in what way?
When journalists from a place like Time magazine approach a leader and say, we want to make you Person of the Year, generally they put on their best self, and they're trying to be liked and want us to project an image of somebody who is brilliant and likable. He didn't do any of that. He really... And maybe it was theater, but he really projected the sense that he didn't care about us. He didn't care about this Person of the Year thing. He didn't care if we didn't like him. And as I wrote in this piece, he got up in the middle of dinner and said, well, I could see we're done, and walked out of the room, which is an extraordinarily rude thing for anybody to do.
I mean, socially, he seems kind of awkward, but also he's got a chip on his shoulder, the way you describe it in your story.
He does, and that's the first thing that comes out, that he, you know, the U.S. and the West was very triumphal about, quote-unquote, winning the Cold War. And it was clear that the opposite reaction to that was Putin's, which was, this was a humiliation, and Russia would never forget, and that Russia would rise again. This is the moment now, 2014, when I think some of that is playing out. But I asked him the most basic question. I said, what are some misconceptions about Russia that the West has that you'd like to clear up? And he just went on this rant about how he thinks the West perceives Russians as still sort of wild, still savage, that they've just, he used this odd phrase, they've just climbed down from the trees and need to get the sand out of their beards. I mean, it was a very strange rant, but it clearly represented this chip on his shoulder, as you say, that he has about a Western sense that the Russians are backward.
If it was theater, why do you think he might have taken that tack?
Well, again, I think part of his effort was to not be cuddly, to not appear to be playing along with the Person of the Year artifice. I think it actually meant a lot to him. I think he really wanted that... And he did play along. He gave us 3.5 hours of an interview. But once it was done and we were there and sitting in his dacha talking to him, I think he just wanted to project that I play by my rules, not yours. I don't care what you do, what you think of me. I'm in charge. I'm not playing along with any kind of Western perception of me or what I should be or what Russia should be.
As you consider the crisis in Ukraine, Adi, also in Crimea and the eastern part of Ukraine now, and you think about that man you met on that day in 2007, what are the things about Putin that keep coming back in your mind and questions that keep coming back in your mind?
Well, we talked at length about the breakup of the Soviet Union, and Putin kept referring to the breakup as a tragedy. And I think he meant that in the profoundest sense. You know, he certainly was politic enough not to say that, well, Russia would like to reacquire territory, but he phrased it a different way, that suddenly all these ethnic Russians, these Russian speakers who lived in the various Soviet republics were cut off from Russia, that they didn't have a vote, that they were under threat somehow. We asked him, will Ukraine ever become part of Russia again, does he think? And he said, no, absolutely not. I mean, certainly spoke in a kind of post-Cold War language. But it was clear that the breakup of the Soviet Union was the tragedy of his life. And now in 2014, he seems to be doing something about rectifying it.
I mean, I know Putin was KGB, and he says the breakup of the Soviet Union was a tragedy. But, I mean, it was communism and that Soviet empire, save a few satellites that were attached to it, that isolated the USSR from the rest of the world. I mean, why does he see that as a tragedy, and why does he want to kind of almost reproduce that now, do you think?
Well, I don't think he wants to reproduce anything that you would really call communist. I think you have to go back to the history of empire. I mean, you know, empires wax and wane, and I guess I view Putin more as a modern day czar who has figured out a way, using this justification that there's a threat to Russians in part of Ukraine, to reabsorb territory. So it's not about communism and that ideal. It's really about expanding Russia's empire.
It seems to me that a lot of the head-scratching about Putin right now, it's really about trust, and it seems a lot of what you experienced that night at Putin's dacha shook your trust in this man. I mean, he pours out wine, but he doesn't drink any of it. He promises a meal on an embossed menu, and by the way, you can't have it all. He leaves early. So can Putin be trusted?
You know, we obviously can't make a judgment after 3.5 hours. I mean, he was... He didn't lie. He didn't, you know, say things that were patently false. You know, one got the sense that this is a powerful guy. I mean, I mentioned that he hardly seemed to blink. He had this sort of intense level of self-control that I've rarely seen. Mostly we got the impression from Putin that he was a kind of intense. I kept writing notes in the margins. This is not a cuddly guy. I mean, I just had never met anybody who was that prickly, that intense, that challenging an interview.
Adi Ignatius, thanks very much for telling us about this interesting little dinner you had with Vladimir Putin back in 2007. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Prickly, intense, not cuddly. That's probably not the image you get of Vladimir Putin from most Russian news outlets. The Kremlin keeps a tight control on the Russian media. There are independent voices, but as Charles Maines reports now from Moscow, it's getting harder to find them.
Over the past couple years in Russia, there's been this kind of game around any protest or march. Call it the numbers game. People gather, and almost instantly everyone's wondering how many showed up this time. Take last week's March for Peace in Moscow. Police estimated the crowd at 3,000, and you'd think they'd have the best vantage point with those police helicopters hovering overhead. But a reasonable man would look at that same crowd and wonder if there were 30,000, 40,000 or more calling for peace in Ukraine. That's not the view of Dmitry Kiselyov, a news anchor who's emerged as the Kremlin's primary voice on national state television. In his weekly news program, Vesti Nedelya, Kiselyov pours on the conspiracies. The protesters were traitors, fascists, or a secret fifth column working with the U.S. to destroy Russia from within. He's warned Russia can turn the U.S. into radioactive ash, called for the hearts of gays to be incinerated, and theorized that Obama's hair went gray out of fear of Putin. So some might say he's an unreasonable man on national television. A crowd of protesters chants, "Хватит врать, enough of the lies." Many in the opposition see a state media campaign aimed at misrepresenting the events in Ukraine and drumming Russia towards war. You can still find independent news, this woman says. There's BBC, her friend adds, and the local Echo of Moscow radio station, chimes in her friend, and other websites. That's where you can get the real news. But according to journalist Leonid Parfionov, dissenting or even nuanced views in the Russian media are increasingly hard to come by.
External events in Ukraine are rippling inside Russia. The people came here not only to support Ukraine, they came to support Russia and the shrinking freedoms they have left.
And Parfionov knows what he's talking about. A decade ago, Parfionov was the star anchor at the independent NTV news channel. It was known for critical coverage of the government, but NTV quickly came under state control when Putin came to power. Observers regard the demise of the old NTV as a watershed moment in Russia's struggle for a free and independent press. Since then, the internet has emerged as the preferred haven for unfettered debate. The web's moment came in December 2011. Tens of thousands of Russians used social media to organize and protest the results of fraud elections. The Kremlin took notice. With the recent protests in Ukraine, the Russian government has moved to curb online freedoms at home. It's blocked several websites, including blogs of leading opposition figures, for airing extremist views. Pressure has also been mounting on the online Dozh TV channel for sympathetic coverage of the Kiev protests. And this month, Galina Timchenko, the longtime editor of Russia's number one online news service, Lenta.ru, was abruptly dismissed for publishing nuanced interviews with members of Ukraine's nationalist right sector. Speaking on Echo of Moscow radio station, Timchenko acknowledged the internet's days as a free medium in Russia were numbered, a victim of its growing relevance.
До них очень долго не доходило, что такое интернет.
When there was 20 million people on the internet, the government paid little attention to it. But now that every second person in Russia is online, they finally realize the influence it has. That it's not just a small group of people entertaining themselves, but a means of mass communication with enormous potential. So you could say our time has finally come.
Back at the Moscow March for Peace, blogger Oleg Kozarov also takes a pessimistic view. He says a hysteria has taken hold in pro-government circles. Those with different views, he says, are demonized as enemies of the state. Worse yet, he says, they truly believe it.
It's really a dangerous situation where the head of the country is surrounded by people who view their own citizens with aggression for having different views. They really have a distorted view of the world and what's happening abroad and in Russia. Not once have the authorities tried to use a method other than force to respond to us.
As we're talking, Kozarov points out the helicopters hovering overhead, the police dogs to the left of us, and the arrest wagons all around us. And this is a peace march, Kozarov says. I mean, what is all this? A reasonable man might say he had a point. For The World, this is Charles Maines in Moscow.
A quick musical note before we head to the break. It's a song from Norway that all the kids are hot on this week. It's the new single from Norwegian band and production duo Lemet. They're based in Oslo, known for dance tracks with structures way more complex than verse, verse, chorus, bridge. This new song is called High Tide. It's a love song and already being tipped as a must-listen summer track. Yeah, I know. We're just starting spring, and here in Boston, they're still talking about more snow next week. But hey, think positive, people.
Now the tide's coming in, but heaven knows it didn't mean to sin. Shine hard, stay afloat, but drown, I shot a hole through my boat. Waves crashing in, on starboard side, realize I might have lost the fight. And the sea is way too rough, looks like I'm going into the abyss. But you know, I know, you know, I know, you know, I know.
Norway's Le Maître there, we'll call it spring music. And speaking of spring, getting to know Nowruz better, next here on The World, from PRI, that's Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-mile run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Spring is here, so go ahead. Put on new clothes and play some goldfish on the table. Not your usual spring rituals, I know. Those are two ways to celebrate Nowruz. That's a New Year's holiday celebrated in Iran and throughout Central Asia, starting on the first day of spring. If you've never heard of Nowruz, not to worry. Neither had the Iranian-American comedian you're about to meet. Kayvon Moezi says it took moving from Arizona to L.A. for him to find out about his own culture's holiday, so he decided to make a short documentary about it. It's called Kayvon Presents A Splash of Nowruz. Thanks for joining us, Kayvon. Good to meet you.
Hey, thank you for having me. And I want to say Eid Shoma Mubarak. Today and right now marks the Persian New Year. So
Happy New Year.
We are celebrating on the air together.
Well, I want to start our listeners getting a taste of what you do by playing a clip from the film where you're doing stand-up for an Iranian audience. Let's start there and we'll come back in a second.
I want to apologize. None of my comedy will be in Farsi tonight. Not even a little bit. I know, it's a shame. And if you want to blame someone, don't blame the organizers, don't blame me, blame my dad. I'll give you his email address, okay? You know where my dad raised our family? Reno, Nevada.
Okay, so maybe that has something to do why you're not doing any Farsi in your stand-up. So you're joking you blame your dad, Kayvon, but what was it like growing up Iranian in Reno, Nevada, of all
There
places?
Are many ways to celebrate.
Well, that's the whole point, is I didn't even grow up Iranian because my dad was trying to lay low. He had moved from Iran a little before the revolution, and he wanted to raise his family all American. So he bought a cowboy hat, he bought a pickup truck, and we had the non-Iranian traditional lifestyle and just regular stuff.
So how much did you actually know about your culture?
Well, I knew very little other than the food, which is always a good place to start because it's delicious. And that is why I made this documentary. It's kind of like if you never knew about Christmas, and then when you turn 25, all your friends tell you about it. You would be pretty upset too, Marco.
Yeah, I can imagine. kind of confusing because your name sounds very Iranian. Kayvon Moezi, that's Iranian, right?
Right, and my dad picked my name to be Kayvon, so I can go by Kevin growing up. My brother Shaheen could go by Sean growing up, so it was a way to kind of fit in. Once I got into stand-up comedy, I started getting invited because of my name to a lot of Persian or Iranian events, and I had to tell jokes to people that the only people I knew Iranian growing up were my aunt and uncle. And so I had a whole new world of people to try to please, and they're kind of a tough audience sometimes. And we show that in the documentary, how sometimes you can't crack them. The Persian grandma, you know, she's wearing her hijab. You can't even tell by her facial reactions if she's laughing because it's covered up, that kind of stuff. So there's some challenges there.
So tell us a bit about Persian New Year, Nowruz. It begins on the first day of spring. How did you first learn about it?
I first learned about Nowruz because I was at a stand-up comedy show, and they're like, and by the way, it's a Nowruz event, so keep it clean. And I go, what is that? And they couldn't believe it.
This is like an Iranian stand-up show?
Yeah, it was like an Iranian event. It looked like a wedding, but no one was getting married. I was kind of confused. And then they had grass on the table and a fish on the table. And I go, what is this? Well, basically, it's like a Christmas tree. Here's what I realize about Nowruz. If you quit thinking of it as a foreign holiday and compare it to what you already know, it's actually pretty understandable.
Yeah, what does it look like in terms of an American holiday?
Nowruz predates Easter, and Nowruz has painted eggs on their table to represent fertility. Nowruz is like a birthday party for Mother Nature, but it's also a Nowruz, you know, a New Year's party, and it's also like Thanksgiving. There's a huge feast. So it's really what I call the greatest hits of all holidays. You got to love Nowruz.
And you've got these tables with grass and goldfish. What's up with that?
Everything on the table has a meaning, and it's kind of nice. There's seven things on the table. It's called the hafsin, which means seven things that start with S. And in the language of, you know, Persian or Farsi, Seeb is apple, that means health. And sabzeh means regrowth and rebirth, you know, that kind of stuff.
You get new clothes, I'm told?
That's one of the great things is you're supposed to clean the whole house. That's where we think spring cleaning might have come from. And then you have to go buy new clothes and look your best. So you can't beat a holiday that forces you to go shopping.
What does your dad think about your quest to learn about Persian culture? Because he was kind of trying to pull you into the melting pot.
I always joke about it. Like, you're trying to keep Nowruz from me, save money and not buy me new clothes. But I don't think it was a conspiracy quite like that. He just wanted me to fit in and get along. And I think he's kind of excited, as is the whole family, that, hey, I took an extra interest in the holiday now.
Hey, listen, before you go, Kayvon, how do you say Happy Nowruz?
Well, you can say Nowruz Piruz, and you can say Eid Shoma Mubarak.
Eid Shoma Mubarak. How's that?
There you go.
Kayvon Moezi, a comedian who lives in Los Angeles. He recently directed and starred in the short film Kayvon Presents A Splash of Nowruz. Thanks for your time, Kayvon.
Thank you for having me.
There are many ways to celebrate the Persian New Year, and at least one of them involves fire. So be careful out there. Here's reporter Shuka Kalantari.
I'm in a backyard in San Francisco with a group of my friends. Many are Iranian like me. We're all taking turns jumping over a fire contained in large cast iron pans. We're celebrating Chorshanbe Suri, part of the Iranian New Year. And this flame jumping ceremony is just one of tonight's rituals. My friend, Yasi Mawaz Khan, a Pakistani-Iranian, rallied our friends for the event.
Well, I love fire. So any reason to make a fire is right up my alley. And I think it's a really good way, like symbolically, the ritual of, you know, burning away the bad energy from the last year and making room for new energy in the new year.
Each time Yasi or other people jump over the fire, they shout this phrase.
Zardi man az to, sorkhi to az man.
They're singing, Zardi man az to, sorkhi to az man. It means, my yellow is yours, your red is mine. It's a Zoroastrian purification chant. As you hop over the fire, you ask to be rid of any sickness and bad luck, and wish for good luck and health in the new year. My other friend, Tara Sami, hosted the party. She was born in Iran, but raised in the U.S. And she sees nights like this as holding on to her culture. She also loves that it all marks the start of spring.
Because I think it's so important, the first day of spring, and the seeds that you're planting for the year to come. And this is part of that, this purification ritual of jumping over the fire. We're asking for the strength of the fire.
Along with the fire jumping, we sing, dance, and eat. There's always ush, a Persian stew made with beans, spinach, cilantro, parsley, broth, and rice or noodles. Back in Iran, people make cauldrons of it for the new year and serve it in the streets to the homeless. Yasi made a big pot for the party.
It's traditional to make ush on Chorshanbe Suri because usually it's pretty cold at this time, although tonight's a very nice night. Yeah, and it's a great way to make a one-pot meal for lots of people.
And then someone in the group breaks out the tombak, a Persian drum made with animal hide and solid wood. But this is only the beginning of Persian New Year parties. There are two more weeks of eating and singing ahead, all festivities to celebrate the arrival of spring. For the world, I'm Shuka Kalantari, San Francisco.
By the way, do you know which New Year Iranians are welcoming this Nowruz? 1393. And in the Buddhist Nirvana calendar, the year is 2558. And there are many more numbers. We've got a blog post at PRI.org to help you figure out all the different years. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, Russians make fun of President Obama's sanctions with mock bans of their own.
There was a Labrador with a sign, Barack Obama prohibited from stroking this dog.
Well, the president will likely get a warmer welcome next week in Holland.
There is even an Obama Club in the Netherlands, the first Obama Club in the world.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. One of President Obama's sanctions against Russia targets a specific bank. It's called Rossiya, and officials in Washington describe it as a personal bank for senior Russian officials. Well, today, President Vladimir Putin himself seemed to laugh the punishment off. He said he personally doesn't have an account at Rossiya, but will transfer his money there by Monday. Putin's not alone in mocking the American sanctions. Many Russians are going online to post pictures that make fun of the measures and of Obama himself. The BBC's Dmitry Shishkin says many of the pictures show signs that ban the U.S. president from doing various things.
So we have seen lots of things. For example, how Barack Obama is prohibited from using a toilet, for example, in a particular place, or buying anything in the particular shop. Or even, can you imagine, even there was a Labrador with a sign, Barack Obama and members of U.S. Congress are prohibited from stroking this dog.
And is it going at all in the other direction? Like, here are a few fake sanctions on Putin?
The funniest I saw this morning, actually, is that four smaller pictures in one, and all of them representing various representatives of American administration, Obama, Hillary Clinton, and John McCain as well, and someone else, I can't remember who the fourth was, but they all looking extremely distraught, covering their faces with arms and with their hands and everything, and just saying a little saying underneath of that, oh my God, I will never be able to keep rubles in the Russian bank. Oh my God, I'm not going on vacation to Siberia. All this humorous and, you know, clearly laughing at the reaction towards the sanctions.
I mean, you say these pictures are coming from across Russia, but do you know if these are independent tweets or does the Kremlin have a hand in crafting them?
So there is no doubt that in the past, Kremlin has been using social media for galvanizing the public opinion to a particular issue. That there is no doubt about that. So this is not unheard of. But as far as I can tell, there is nothing to suggest that this is an orchestrated campaign. I think it's exactly this example of a viral thing. Then someone comes up with this idea and then people start replicating it, because the scope was pretty interesting. I mean, we have seen a picture of a prohibition note from a dormitory, from a student dormitory, which was done in a very, very funny way as well. So it seems to me that this is not orchestrated, but, you know, you never know about those things, do you?
No, you don't. I mean, but if it's viral, I mean, it's still interesting that it kind of is emblematic of some kind of trend. I know it's funny, you know, I mean, don't pee here and don't pet this dog, but what bigger issues do these memes kind of address, do you think?
I think the really important thing here is that Russia is becoming increasingly isolationist in its policies, and we probably are facing the biggest international crisis since the start of the Cold War, some people are saying. And the important thing here is that in the age of social media, in the age of the free access to different means of information and the rest of things, people are able to take to make their own choices in terms of what they're listening to and where they get their information from. But at the same time, you can see that the majority of the country, at least, is very much galvanized behind the president at this particular moment. There is this, I guess, feeling of defiance. People are yet to understand what exactly the economic consequences for the country itself are going to be, but it almost seems that currently the people are not thinking about it. They're all thinking, right, the West has finally started to show its true attitude towards Russia, irrespective of what's happening with Crimea, and we need to pull together and kind of oppose it, if you see what I mean.
The BBC's Dmitry Shishkin speaking with us from London. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Over in Turkey, the country's prime minister is picking a fight with social media users. Recep Tayyip Erdogan vowed to eradicate Twitter from Turkey, and today the popular site was blocked by the Turkish government. Within minutes, though, national newspapers posted easy workarounds, and Turks were tweeting like mad. Now, hashtags like Turkey block Twitter are trending worldwide. Jacob Resnick reports from Istanbul.
Twitter, and social media in general, is something Prime Minister Erdogan just loves to hate. Despite calling it a menace during last spring's Gezi Park uprising, his ruling AK Party is pretty tech-savvy. They have to be. Turkey is a very wired country, and with some of the highest rates of users in Europe, political battles are often waged in the Twitter sphere. But a corruption scandal broke last December that implicated the government in widespread graft, and damning evidence continues to surface every few days on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Some conversations have included the big man himself. Yesterday, Erdogan had had enough. At a rally for upcoming local elections, he vowed to use a new internet law passed last month to take Twitter down.
Twitter Schmitter. We have a court order now. We will wipe out all of these. The international community can say this or that. I don't care at all. Everyone will see how powerful the Republic of Turkey is.
Within hours, some people started noticing that Twitter wasn't loading on their regular internet. But some 40,000 websites are already barred by the government, so many people in Turkey know exactly how to change their internet settings to avoid the censorship. That's why Istanbul resident Aylin Vural says despite the ban, little will change.
I am a Twitter user for a very long time. It is now blocked because people were sharing their opinions there. He thinks we cannot criticize him if he shuts down Twitter, but nothing will change with this ban.
The absurdity doesn't end there. Earlier today, Abdullah Gül, the president of the country, condemned the decision on Twitter. His tweet said that he knows how to fiddle with his computer settings too, and that banning social media sites isn't appropriate. So why did the government ban Twitter? Some of the wiretaps posted on YouTube and broadcast on Twitter showed the prime minister browbeating media executives about their political coverage and them kowtowing to pressure. Amnesty International's man in Turkey, Andrew Gardner, says Twitter and the internet in general is one sphere the prime minister can't silence with an angry phone call.
The government can't sort of mete out the intimidation and threats that they do on the national media. So that's why it represents such a threat for, a government which is increasingly authoritarian and engaged in control freakery.
A lot of people here are taking the news in stride with wry amusement. And online, it appears to be business as usual. Cybercritic Erkan Saka, who lectures at Istanbul's Bilgi University, says the government isn't strong enough to effectively shut down social media. But he warns this could go further.
What I am more anxious is that they might try to criminalize these circumvention practices. They might sort of intimidate users.
Crude bans are one thing, but criminalization is another. Turkey is a country where people have been jailed for tweeting. Some cases were for allegedly inciting unrest, but others have been prosecuted for so-called insults of public figures. Saka says people are becoming wary, and self-censorship is an issue. Already spoofs of the debacle are popping up, including this arcade game where one pilots a Flappy Bird in the shape of Erdogan's head through obstacles. When you die, a high-pitched voice squeals that the people of Turkey are little more than like the hairs on Erdogan's posterior. It's a real comment from an interview with an elderly fan at an Erdogan rally last year, which just goes to show that Twitter or no Twitter, the guy still has diehard supporters. For The World, I'm Jacob Resnick in Istanbul.
The tweets out of Turkey make for some fascinating reading today, particularly for our global cartoons editor, who's pulled together her favorite cartoons for us about Turkey's Twitter ban. Take a look at PRI.org. I want you to think back now to 2002. 9/11 was fresh on everyone's minds, and the Bush administration was trying to get European allies behind the idea of invading Iraq. Remember the infamous weapons of mass destruction? You might also recall that France was a big obstacle to Bush's plan, and that gave rise to some anti-French sentiments. Some U.S. politicians even renamed French fries freedom fries. Well, the French view from that time is recounted in a farcical way in a graphic novel called Quai d'Orsay. It's written by Antonin Baudry, who in 2002 was working as a speechwriter for then-French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin. He's the one who made a famous speech declaring France's opposition to the war. That graphic novel has now been turned into a film, a comedy, and it opens today in the U.S. under the title The French Minister. It's a bit like The Office meets French farce, all set in the French Foreign Ministry. Antonin Baudry says it's an apt comparison.
It's very frequent in any organization that when there are a lot of emergency at the same time, there's a kind of frantic atmosphere, and everyone is really very, very dedicated. I mean, somehow there's a kind of hysteria, it's true, but also it's very, very dedicated, serious, smart people who try to do their job. And my belief is that, and that's what I wanted to show in the comic books and in the film, that from a chaotic process can emerge a very rational move and decision. They decided to refuse a war that had no purpose, actually.
Now, we're talking about the invasion of Iraq in 2003, correct?
Correct.
Now, when you were in the ministry, Antonin, what surprised you about how the whole thing worked? And what did you find funny?
Well, actually, I didn't know anything about diplomacy and politics when I arrived. I arrived as a speech writer. So I had been hired because I loved writing and this kind of stuff, but I didn't know anything about the way it worked. So I was surprised basically by everything. I was surprised by the grandeur, by the magnificent places opposed to those very small offices where the people were working. I was surprised by the energy there was day and night. I mean, 24/7, people working. I was surprised by the smartness of many people. And I was surprised also by some civil servants who are really, for me, models. They don't spend any money, any public money on unuseful things. They dedicate their whole life, they sacrifice their private life for the good of the common interest.
Right. I mean, there is this kind of funny French contradiction in your portrayal of the whole foreign ministry, that kind of fraternité, égalité, liberté thing happening with this real aristocratic old world approach to global affairs.
It's always a synthesis between ideas, principles, ideals, and the way things happen. And you don't have time to think. The point is you don't have time to think. So you really stick to what you believe in. And sometimes you honestly don't know what's going to happen next. But actually, the process of writing the comic books with my artist, Christophe Blain, and then of writing the film was close to the process of writing a speech for Dominique de Villepin.
Now, you mentioned Dominique de Villepin. He was the French foreign minister at the time that you worked at the ministry. The man at the top in the graphic novel and the film is a fictional foreign minister named Alexandre Taillard de Worms. So what traits do Worms and Villepin share?
It's an interesting question. So the common point between Taillard de Worms and Villepin is that he has a strong vision of what he thinks must be done. He is always moving. He's always thinking. He's always speaking. He never takes really the time to stop and try to figure out something abstractly. He's always in action.
He's often contradicting himself, too.
Yes. He's not a man. He's a kind of process, always in action.
A work in progress.
Yeah, exactly.
The graphic novel, the movie, they're set right after 9/11. And as you've already alluded to, France was seen as preventing the U.S. from going to war in Iraq over WMD right away. We know what that looked like from this side of the Atlantic with freedom fries and disdain for the French. But was there something else about that moment in France that really turned foreign policy for the French into kind of a more ripe topic for a graphic novel?
It was a very important moment in France because the people didn't want this war, but the elite in France, contrary to what is said a lot in France, the elite was for the war. They really thought that we were making a wrong move by saying no to this war. So now they wouldn't say it anymore. But by this time, there was a lot of pressure. They said, come on, you're not going to say no to this war. The Americans want to do it. It's already decided. Why would you say no? It was all the time.
None of that really came across, though, in the debates at the UN. It always seemed that it was the French versus the United States.
Yeah, because this man, Dominique de Villepin, was really convinced. And actually, when he did this speech, everybody in France was watching it. And it really changed a lot the perception in France. People said, yes, he's right. He's right about that.
Did you write that speech as Antonin Baudry when you were working for him?
Dominique de Villepin wrote that speech. When you're a speechwriter, you help him. But it was his vision, it was his words, it was his ideas.
Antonin Baudry, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You can read Antonin Baudry's graphic novel and watch the trailer to the film based on it at PRI.org. Graphic novels that talk about serious stuff like the ramp up to the invasion of Iraq. Hey, the world is filled with both dark and light, fun and serious. Like the music of Fela Kuti, the late Nigerian music legend. His songs were chock full of serious themes, corruption and dictators. Upbeat, yes, still there's room for more happiness in Fela's music. Because I'm a happy clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. Because I'm a clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth. Because I'm a clap along if you know what happiness is for you. Because I'm a clap along if you feel like that's what you want to do. Here come bad news. That's Fela's colonial mentality as it collides with Pharrell's Happy. Jeff Lawrence, a.k.a. DJ 100 Proof, came up with the idea for the collision. He says he wanted to remix Happy, and the not predictable choice was Fela.
One of the things that I find about his music that's interesting is it always does sort of have a happy feel to it, yet the lyrics are very serious and political and real. And so to be able to combine the overall vibe of happiness from that song and blend it with the lyrics from Pharrell that are genuinely just really positive. I've chopped up the saxophone and the horn parts to sort of go with his chorus, and it really turned out, I mean, better than I would have imagined.
Wishing you a happy mentality. And thanks for the track, DJ 100 Proof. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's hard to trust polls, but there are polls that track President Obama's popularity on a daily basis, and today one of them says he's got a 48% approval rating. Anecdotally, I can tell you he's heading next week to a place where that number is much higher. I'm talking about the Netherlands. And if you listen to historian Willem Post, who lives in The Hague, it all makes sense.
These countries in Western Europe are really Obama countries. I think that has to do with the fact that, well, this is a U.S. president who calls himself a global citizen. Diplomacy first. Well, that's a little bit different than in the Bush era. And here, this nuclear security summit in The Hague, that is multilateral phenomenon and one of the top priorities of the president. So people see, okay, this is Obama once again stressing diplomacy and let's do it together.
I mean, I was in London about a year and a half ago, right before the 2012 election, and I felt that there was some dulling of Obama's kind of polish and reputation. That hasn't really happened in the Netherlands, though.
No, I don't think so. We are very much a strong ally of the United States of America. And, you know, we in the Netherlands also have some sort of a Tea Party movement, like in the U.S. Mr. Geert Wilders is the right-wing populist leader in the Netherlands. He is in the opposition now, but, okay, it's quite a phenomenon. So in the Netherlands, a lot of people understand what the challenge is for President Obama in the United States itself, in this very polarized political climate. So people understand how complicated it is, how complicated the world is. And in these small, rather small Western European countries, we also feel ourselves, compared with superpower, we feel ourselves vulnerable. And then you have to work together. And, well, let's be honest, Obama is the first president who talks about the U.S. We don't have unlimited power, the budget cuts in the military. We understand in Western Europe that, well, we're all in this together, and a multilateral behavior, that is what a lot of people in Western Europe ask from the president in Washington, be also an actor in this whole field of diplomacy.
Is it true there are Obama clubs in the Netherlands?
Yeah, there is even an Obama Club in the Netherlands, the first Obama club in the world, the largest.
What do they do at these clubs?
Well, they like to shake his hand, of course, but very serious discussions about an issue like diversity. Well, the first African-American president that made an incredible impression here in the Netherlands, his whole message of reaching out to the Arab world. And yeah, the Dutch are sober Calvinists still a bit. So we are not so used to the magic of Obama in the campaigns, but it's a very, very warm welcome the president gets here in the Netherlands.
What did the revelations of NSA surveillance by Edward Snowden do to dull President Obama's image in the Netherlands?
Well, of course, it's a big issue. On the other hand, we also know that we live in a time where secret services are having their role. And you know, this whole nuclear security summit, the Dutch are not that stupid. We all know terrorism is there, so you have to take your measures. So although there is a lot of criticism on this whole Snowden thing and the NSA, we also know that our own security services work together with the British and the American secret services. It's not a big, big issue for the general public. So from an international perspective, here we have a president who governs in a transition era. And we can relate to this as smaller countries with our vulnerability.
So a lot of reasons for Obama love in Holland. Lest anyone forget, the president is actually going to be there to meet Chinese President Xi Jinping in The Hague. And also he's going to have this nuclear security meeting as well. Any specific examples of how the Dutch will be rolling out the red carpet next week?
Now, the President Obama will go to Amsterdam to look at the Night Watch, one of our most famous paintings. Maybe also to The Hague, watching the Victory Boogie Woogie of Piet Mondrian. Those are very famous paintings. He is an art lover. I don't think there is a lot of time, but we hope that President Obama will visit the Obama Club in the Netherlands, because his most passionate fans, they are in the Netherlands, the number one Obama club. So, well, we will see what happens these coming days.
Time for one painting, Night Watch, and that would be, of course, by the great
Rembrandt
van Rijn.
Yeah, definitely.
I was testing you, Willem.
Well, this is a question I know.
Of course you do. Willem Post, U.S. history and foreign policy specialist and Hague resident. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Before we head out, there's a story this week that we haven't tackled yet. I'm talking about the discovery of evidence from the Big Bang that gave birth to our universe. I know it's a big deal, but I don't really understand it. Our frequent contributor, writer, and musician Alina Simone kind of feels the same way, but for her, it's personal. That's because her dad, Alexander Vilenkin, is a physicist. His work turns up a lot in science magazines and TV shows like Nova, and sometimes in headlines. Here's Alina.
The truth is, I suck at physics. I barely got a C in high school, and that was only with a lot of help from you-know-who. I went to the same university where my dad still teaches physics, and as a freshman wanted to take his introductory class, which was sort of legendary. To demonstrate conservation of energy, he'd hold a heavy pendulum to his head and let it swing out across the lecture hall and back while standing stock still. To illustrate the Leidenfrost effect, he would stick his hand into a vat of liquid nitrogen. I figured if my dad was going to freeze his hand off in front of hundreds of students, I should at least be one of them. But he threatened not to teach intro physics if I signed up. "Don't make me flunk my own daughter," he said. I also think I remember him mentioning he could train a monkey to do physics better than me. Ouch. But I wanted to congratulate him about the big news in his world, or multi-worlds, and maybe try to wrap my head around it a little. Okay, Dad, so what did they discover?
They discovered gravitational waves. Gravitational waves are, you know, like radio waves, like electromagnetic waves. They are distortions in the geometry of space and time. And they were predicted.
Somehow this is always where I fade out, right when distortions in the geometry of space and time kick in. I try putting this in my terms, picturing the universe as a burrito, only now it's somehow crumpled, like maybe someone sat on it.
Take heart, my little friend, and push back your seat.
Mark Everett, the leader of the rock band Eels, is also the son of a physicist, the late Hugh Everett, whose work in quantum physics made him world famous. The BBC actually did a one-hour special following Mark as he tried to unpack his father's theories of parallel worlds. I think that's when I realized what it would take for me to understand my dad's work. A six-month boot camp with the world's greatest physicists, a $1 million production, a phalanx of consultants. Then maybe, just maybe, I'd be able to tell a cosmic string from, like, a shoelace or something. Or maybe I shouldn't stress it. According to my dad, there's a parallel world where I'm the fancy physicist, and he's on the radio, joking about how he can't understand a word I say. For The World, this is Alina Simone from New York.
I'll pick some daisies from the flower bed of the Galaxy Theater.
Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. You have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Annenberg Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org, the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at Carnegie.org, the Ford Foundation, the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nor Hall.
PRI, Public Radio International.